From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After a long depression led her into therapy, Lorraine Bracco landed the part of Tony Soprano's psychiatrist. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with her about playing Dr. Melfi. Bracco was first offered the role of Carmela, Tony's wife on The Sopranos, but Bracco turned it down because it was too close to her starring role in Goodfellas. Bracco has a new memoir. Also, we talk with the Dixie Chicks about their new album and their old controversy, the one that led many country stations to stop playing their music. Their new CD premiered at number one on the Billboard album chart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, now we have to wait until next year to see the final episodes of The Sopranos. The final season of the HBO series is divided into two parts, and part one ended Sunday. But the good news is that now we get to talk about The Sopranos with one of its stars, Lorraine Bracco. She plays Dr. Melfi, Tony's psychiatrist. Her second best-known role is as the wife of wise guy Henry Hill in Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas. Bracco has a new memoir called On the Couch, in which she not only describes treating Tony for his depression and panic attacks, she describes her own bout with depression. Let's start with a scene from a recent episode. Tony Soprano is in Dr. Melfi's office. He's just told her he hates his son, AJ.
Anthony, I think your anger towards AJ has been building for some time. We have to deal with this.
All I know is it's a good thing my father's not alive, because let me tell you, he'd find his f***ing hilarious.
Find what hilarious?
The kind of son I produced.
You mean because Anthony doesn't conform to your father's idea of what a man should be?
His, mine, or anybody's. Let me tell you, if Carmela let me kick AJ's ass like my father kicked my ass, he might have grown up with some balls.
Like you?
Yeah, like me.
He might have also grown up taking out his anger at his father's brutality towards him on others. He might have grown up with a desperate need to dominate and control. Anthony, we've been dancing around this for years. How you live. What is it you want from your life?
I couldn't even hit him if I wanted to. He's so f***ing little. It's Carmela's side of the family. They're small people. Her father, you could knock him over with a f***ing feather.
Okay. But I have to point out, what you resent Carmela doing for AJ, protecting him from his father, is the very thing you had often wished your mother had done for you.
Lorraine Bracco, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the best advice you've ever given Tony Soprano?
Ooh, over the years. Ooh, good question. You know, I do love the fact that she continues to try to make him look at his relationship with the mother. I think that's a very important aspect of his issues. And so anything that surrounds Livia, I think, is always very interesting. I don't know if it's advice in the advice sense, but I like all the stuff with the mother. I think it's all very, very interesting. And, of course, pokes and prods him in ways that he squirms, and I like that.
I can't remember how many seasons ago this was when your character was raped.
Yes.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, it's such a violation of your character. I don't mean a script writing violation. I mean, rape is an incredible violation. And on the one hand,
I was stunned.
Yeah, on the one hand, when something major happens in the life of one of the characters, it seems like good news for the actor because you get more attention. But did you feel the pain, you know, when the character was raped?
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, David came to me and said, okay, I don't remember what season or what episode, but he said, you know, come into my office, and we sat down, and he started to tell me the story, and I was like, what? Why would you hurt Dr. Melfi? Why would you do that to her? Well, it's a random rape. I said, David, I'm the only decent person here. Why would you do that to me? And he said, okay, all right, let's not get hysterical. Read the script and call me. So he gave me the script, you know, a couple of weeks or a month before, you know, we were even going to go into it. And I read the script and I read it again. And it was the second time that I read it, I said, okay, I get it. It wasn't about hurting Dr. Melfi. It wasn't the violence against her. What it was her morality. And yes, she could have told Tony. And yes, she could have become a gangster.
She could have asked him for revenge, and he would have gladly taken revenge.
Of course he would have. But it was the question of her morality. Who was she? And to me, that was so much bigger than anything. And a lot of people, I'm not sure 100% got that. I mean, my father was standing up, screaming at the television, screaming, tell him, tell him. And I mean, you know, it was like, well, then she would have just become one of them.
So did you like the way it was resolved in the script?
Yes, I do. But I read it twice. And David, and then when we really got into it, we talked about the fact that if you're going to do this, then you need to really do it. And don't do it like primetime television where they don't show the violence. And I think, which has been a huge, for me, a huge issue of why violence is so big in the States. Because if you're going to watch it on television and you never see anybody really get violated, well, what the hell?
Describe how you handled the scene, the violent scene.
Oh, it was just despicable. It was despicable, and I hated it, and I suffered. I even ripped open my bursar sac in my shoulder, and I needed surgery. I fought back. I screamed, I'm a mother, don't do this. You know, it was awful.
Now, David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, wanted you to play Carmela, Tony's wife, when the series was starting, but you turned that down. It's such a big part and such a great part. You say in your book that you didn't want to play another mob wife after you became so famous for that in Goodfellas. But I still think that must have been really hard to turn that down. Did you ever have second thoughts about turning it down, seeing what a great role it was?
Well, with David, when we talked about it, I did it. I didn't think I could do it any better. And Melfi jumped off the page for me. I thought she was an Italian-American educated woman, someone we've never seen, a relationship with a mobster character that you've never seen. That was exciting to play.
Now, when the series started, you were going through a terrible depression, which you write about in your new memoir. You were going through a bad separation with Harvey Keitel, who you'd been with for years. You had a daughter together, and you were having a custody battle over your daughter. Oh, and you were very, very deep in debt, like $2 million, in part because of the steep legal fees that you had to pay. And you finally went into therapy. Did therapy help you through that depression?
Oh, yes, it did. And medication helped me.
What are the therapy, since you're playing a therapist now and have to really think about the value and the limitations of therapy, what did the therapy do for you? What are some of the insights that it gave you that you could actually use to change your life?
All right, well, when you ask that question, my mind is going all over the place. A couple of things I want you to know. David Chase has been through therapy. And when I met David and we talked about Dr. Melfi, one of the things I said to him was, listen, I don't really know you very well right now and you don't know me, but I've been in therapy and I've been in crisis mode. And therapy was very, very important to me. And I told him also that I'd been on medication. And he was very open, and I say we had a very strong meeting. And I was very open with him because I didn't want him to think that, besides it was a great role that I loved, it was something that I was working on. And I said to him, the therapy had been very important to me, and I wasn't willing to make a mockery of therapy. I was not willing to become the psycho killer. I wasn't willing to become the sex fiend psychiatrist. And if he had those plans for this character, I was not his girl. Because in my own life, I always felt it saved me. And David was very honest and open with me and said he'd been in therapy and been through a lot. And no, he wasn't going to make a mockery of the therapy. Would he take a little artistic license? Yes. I said, that I could live with. But I won't live with, you know, the sex fiend psychiatrist who, you know, dances in the bada bing.
You know, you were really in need of money at this point and in need of work. And I guess it's kind of risky when somebody is offering you a good part to first turn down the part they offered you, second, suggest the part that you think would be better for you, and then third, explain if you don't like the way he's writing that part, you're not going to take that either.
Look, I'm a love me or leave me kind of girl. What can I tell you? I couldn't be more honest, more upfront, more decent to myself. And I think David saw that.
My guest is Lorraine Bracco. She plays Dr. Melfi on The Sopranos, and she has a new memoir called On the Couch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorraine Bracco, and she plays Dr. Melfi, Tony Soprano's therapist on The Sopranos. Now she has a new memoir, and it's called On the Couch. Now, you first became really well-known for your role in Goodfellas as Karen Hill, the woman who becomes the wife of the wise guy of the film, the small-time mobster, Henry Hill. It was directed by Martin Scorsese, who you already knew through your longtime partner, Harvey Keitel. So you say in your book that, you know, you had auditioned for one of Scorsese's earlier movies and he didn't give you that part, but he said he would give you a part someday. And Goodfellas was that someday. And you also say that you didn't exactly audition for it. What was, if it wasn't an audition exactly, what was it?
Well, Marty had met me. He knew me. I had already worked a little bit. So he'd seen me on the screen. And what he did was he had me come up to his apartment and meet him and Ray Liotta. And we sat and talked and had a drink for a while and talked about the book. I read the book. He hadn't given me a script yet, so I had read the book. So I had something to talk about. And I think what he was doing was really matching me up with Ray.
In the film, your character of Karen is Jewish, and of course Henry Hill is Italian.
Italian Irish.
Now you grew up in you're Catholic. You grew up in Bay Ridge, and then when you were a little older, your family moved to a neighborhood in Long Island that was primarily Jewish. And you said, you know, all your friends were in B'nai B'rith, so you wanted to join too, even though you're Catholic, but that's what everybody was doing. So did spending part of your growing up time in a Jewish neighborhood help you in playing Karen?
I think it's why Marty gave me the role.
How did it help
I
you?
I mean, that's because I knew both sides of the coin. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I was the only, you know, Catholic kid. And I was Catholic with an Italian father at home. So I understood both lives. And that intrigued Marty. And Marty always felt I could play Jewish, not just Italian. I could do that. And the fact that I was from Long Island, and that's where Karen Hill was originally from Lawrence.
Well, I want to play a scene from Goodfellas, and this is a scene you and Henry Hill have recently married, but you're both living in your parents' house. And In this scene, Henry Hill has been out all night, and it's not the first time. And your mother is really mad at him, and I think she's kind of mad at you for marrying him in the first place. So this is a scene with you and your mother.
And just, I know this has got nothing to do with nothing, but you realize Suzanne Shepherd, who plays my mother in Goodfellas, plays... Come on, Terry. Come on, it's a great trivia question.
I don't know.
Plays Edie's mother in Sopranos.
No, really?
Same actress.
I didn't realize that.
Ah, see?
Oh, you got me. That's great.
All right, just a little trivia.
Well, that's great. Well, let's hear the scene and we can think about that as we listen.
He didn't call?
He's with his friends.
What kind of a person doesn't call?
Ma, he's a grown-up. He doesn't have to call every 5 minutes.
If he was such a grown-up, why doesn't he get you to an apartment?
Oy, don't start. Mom, you're the one who wanted us here.
Listen, you're here a month and sometimes I know he doesn't come home at all. What kind of people are these?
Ma. What do you want me to do?
Do? What can you do? He's not Jewish. Did you know how these people live? Did you know what they were like? Your father never stayed out all night without calling.
Stay out? Daddy never went out at all, Ma. Keep out of it. You don't know how I feel.
Feel? How do you feel now? You don't know where he is. You don't know who he's with.
He's with his friends. Dad!
Will you leave him out of this? He suffered enough. The man hasn't been able to digest a decent meal in 6 weeks.
That's my guest, Lorraine Bracco, with Suzanne Shepherd in a scene from Goodfellas. One of the things you write about in your memoir is that when you were young and modeling, you moved to Paris. And while you were living in Europe, one of the people you modeled for was Salvador Dali. What did he ask you to do?
He asked me to pose nude.
And did you do it?
No.
Why not?
I was insulted. I was young, and I felt he was a dirty old man.
Do you think he was a dirty old man?
Yes. But now that I'm older and realize he was one of the great, you know, surrealist painters of our times, I was silly.
Did you not realize how important he was at the time?
No, I didn't know.
So, but you did finally pose for something. Would you describe that pose?
Well, he kept asking and asking and asking and asking, and I was always annoyed. And we did do a photo shoot, which is in the book.
You write in your book that Dali's wife was very uncomfortable with all the women who were modeling for him. Did you see the situation at all from her point of view at the time, or did you think, you know, that she shouldn't have been, you know, getting in the way at all? Did you empathize with her?
Did I empathize with her? Her behavior was so appalling that it was very difficult to empathize.
Oh, what
with
was appalling about her behavior?
Oh, she was just awful. She would push you away I mean, I was there to work. I was not there to, you know, but I think she saw that he liked me. And that annoyed her to death. And she was just verbally abusive in Spanish and not very nice. So it was hard to empathize with her.
I have another question about Dr. Melfi. One of the things I sometimes wonder about Dr. Melfi is this. When seeing Tony Soprano, would she really be wearing skirts and stockings that reveal her very beautiful legs? Or would she be trying to be as, like, non-sexual as possible in a therapy relationship like that?
Okay, so I have a couple of things on the subject. You ready?
Yes.
One, Terry.
Yes?
It is a TV show. And Mr. Gandolfini goes to our fantastic costume designer, Juliet, and begs her to shorten my skirts. Just so you know, a little artistic license there. You know, if you know me and if you meet me, you will see I'm a much more alive woman than Dr. Melfi. And I have a big sexuality about me. So Dr. Melfi is, for me, I work so hard to tone her down and not be me. People just can't believe when they meet me in person, they say, oh my God, they make you so ugly on television. But that's but because I don't bring in me, I don't bring in Lorraine Bracco. Yes, there's a part of me I bring in, but I have to glue my ass down to the chair. I have to get rid of me to make her.
Lorraine Bracco, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're sweet, Terry. I hope you had fun.
Lorraine Bracco plays Dr. Melfi, Tony's psychiatrist, in The Sopranos. Her new memoir is called On the Couch. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Woody Harrelson, Lindsay Lohan, and Meryl Streep, opening June 9th. From Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, the story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Dixie Chicks. In 2003, after a disparaging remark about President Bush, many country stations refused to play their CD. The Dixie Chicks' new CD premiered at number one on the Billboard album chart. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the Dixie Chicks. Perhaps you've heard of them. As you probably know by now, much of their country music audience was furious with them 3 years ago when lead singer Natalie Maines made a disparaging comment about President Bush just before the invasion of Iraq. A lot of country stations stopped playing the Dixie Chicks records, and they had to protect themselves against death threats. They've just released their first new CD since that uproar. It's less country and more pop than their previous recordings. It premiered at number one on the Billboard album chart. The Dixie Chicks already held the record as the biggest-selling female group in history. All three of the Dixie Chicks are with us: Natalie Maines, banjo player Emily Robison, and fiddler Marty McGuire. The group formed in 1989, but it wasn't until 1995 that Maines joined as the lead singer. Let's start with a track from their new CD, Taking the Long Way. This is the first single from the album, Not Ready to Make Nice.
Forgive sounds good. Forgive, I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price.
That's the Dixie Chicks from their new CD, Taking the Long Way. Welcome all of you to Fresh Air. You know,
Thank you. If
I didn't know the controversy over Natalie's remarks, I'd think that this is just a song about a relationship or, you know, with a lover or with a spouse. And I'm wondering if you wrote it specifically about the controversy over Natalie's comments or if you meant it to have a double meaning or what.
No, well, I mean, we definitely wrote it just about our feelings about everything that happened. It was a very emotional song for us to write and to listen to still. But we sort of thought it was the one song in the record that people would definitely know what we were talking about. But it was surprising that lots of people did relate to it and thought it was, you know, if they had an abusive husband or boyfriend, sort of related it that way. But for us, it is definitely a therapy sort of song that we needed to write.
If you don't mind, I'm just going to like read through, just so our listeners, anyone listeners who haven't been following this will know all the quotes and questions. So forgive me, Natalie, as I play your part for a moment. The initial comment that you made was in March 2003, just before we invaded Iraq, and you said at a concert in London, just so you know, we're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas. And then you made an apology of sorts later. You said, as a concerned American citizen, I apologize to President Bush because my remark was disrespectful. I feel that whoever holds that office should be treated with the utmost respect. And then more recently you said, I apologized for disrespecting the office of the president, but I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel he's owed any respect whatsoever. So let's start with the initial comment. Was that, Natalie, was that something you had planned to say? Did you go to the concert saying, this is what I'm going to say. I'm going to use exactly these words. I thought it through very carefully, and this is exactly what I want to say about the president.
That'd be a little sad if that was the quote that I thought about thoroughly. No, it was it was supposed to be the eve of war. The next day was his supposed deadline. So in our minds, war was happening the next day, and nothing was planned. But just what I was thinking when I was on stage was just, it just didn't seem right to not acknowledge. But in my way, you know, I didn't want to get up there and make everyone sad. I sort of wanted to give my point of view, but still in an entertaining way, because we've never preached from stage or that sort of thing. But it was too important to ignore, and we are putting on a music show, so I wasn't going to get on a soapbox about it.
Emily, Marty, were you surprised when Natalie said that?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't, because she always speaks off the cuff, you know, nothing's ever really planned. You know, you can always expect just about anything to come out of Natalie's mouth. But, you know, it's, I definitely, this is Emily speaking, I felt this heat enter my body from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. And I just remember thinking, oh, no, you know, this is going to cause, you know, someone's going to have a problem with this. I didn't have a problem with it. I agreed with her wholeheartedly. But you know, it was one of those things where I just thought it might stir something up, never to the magnitude that it did. You know, I thought it might make the paper, and that was enough to kind of go, ooh, you know, but nothing to where I felt like it was going to be an issue for the rest of our career.
There's been so many stories, some of them myths, about, you know, boycotts on the radio and how your CDs were destroyed and so on. So let's start with what you think of as the most disturbing true story that happened as a result of the anger that was directed at you after Natalie's comment about President Bush and the war?
Well, nothing you just named didn't happen.
I'd like to hear a myth. I've never heard a myth. They're all true. Uh-huh.
More than that happened, though. I think it's interesting, and I'm still baffled that, you know, every tour cycle, we donate $1 million to a worthy cause. That's just how we like to give back. And because we were at war, we felt like donating to the Red Cross was the thing to do, and they turned our money down. They basically wrote us a short, very short note saying thank you, but no thank you.
There were several gatherings to destroy your CDs. What do you think was the most creative way of destroying it that people came up with?
I thought the tractor was pretty good. That got a lot of
a tractor
news time.
The tractor is very symbolic because it was country radio hosting some of these CD crushings, and they'd lay our CDs out on a blanket, and then they'd roll them, either have their listeners stomp on our CDs and crush them, or get a big tractor to destroy them.
How sweet to put a blanket down first.
You got royalties on all those destroyed CDs, though, right?
Sure, yeah, they had to buy them.
But there were death threats, too. I mean, definitely no laughing matter. What kind of death threats did you get?
You know, there were things. There was a radio station in San Antonio where the DJ, or two DJs, said they ought to get a posse together and go teach Natalie a lesson. And they thought that I lived where Emily actually lives. And that was just, you know, it's hard to pick one thing because on a daily basis it got more unbelievable. But just the overall hatred was the worst part for me. But and then, yeah, there was a serious, very specific death threat that came and was taken care of.
Well, let's hear some more music. My guests are the Dixie Chicks, and their new CD is called Taking the Long Way. I want to play another track from your new CD, and this is called I Hope. And you first sang this, or at least the first time I heard it was when you sang it on a TV benefit for the victims of Hurricane Katrina, and this was shortly after the hurricane. Why don't we hear the song, then we'll talk about it a little bit. And here's the Dixie Chicks.
Sunday morning, I heard the preacher say, thou shalt not kill. I don't wanna hear nothing else about killing, and that is God's will.
That's the Dixie Chicks from their new CD, Taken the Long Way, and my guests are the Dixie Chicks. You know, your new CD is produced by Rick Rubin, who, among other things, produced Johnny Cash's last recordings. He produced Neil Diamond's recent comeback record. He's produced a lot of hip-hop and heavy metal. it's as if this the album comes with this statement: this is not a country record. You know, this is something with Rick Rubin as producer taking it in a different direction. Did you want to make that statement with the record?
We just knew we wanted to evolve, and it was freeing to not have to think about a format. We didn't think about any format. And Rick was a great matchup for us because, you know, when we met him and we asked him, "Where, you know, how do you hear us or what would you do with us?" We liked his answer of, you know, "I have no idea what the sound is until you write the songs." And, you know, we went in not knowing at all what the sound was going to be like. But we loved Rick's confidence. I think at that time, maybe creatively, we were lacking some confidence. We've always felt like we were definite co-producers on our records. And, you know, we knew that we needed someone else who knew a lot of other things and different ways to do things and different writers and different musicians. And Rick had that confidence.
My guests are the Dixie Chicks. Their new CD is called Taking the Long Way. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the Dixie Chicks, lead singer Natalie Maines, banjo player Emily Robison, and fiddler Marty McGuire. Their new CD is called Taking the Long Way. Well, there's another song I want to play from your new CD, and this is called Everybody Knows. It's a song that you co-wrote with Gary Louris of the Jayhawks. Tell us the story behind this song, and does this song have an autobiographical element to it?
The intention wasn't for it to be autobiographical. But I think it wound up having that component. And when we were writing it, we thought we were writing it about other people. But when it was finished and you go back and listen, you realize that you were able to tap into some of the emotions and some of the things that we said because they were autobiographical. It was more autobiographical than we thought it was.
Anything else you want to say about it before we hear it?
To me, the chorus is more autobiographical than maybe the verses.
This "swore you'd never see me cry, you'd never see me cry" makes me think kind of about you, Natalie. Just
that, I cry all the time.
But you're the last one to have wanted to really open up your life. You're a very private person, and then all of a sudden you know, people are just wanting to know everything about you. I think that was a hard transition for you. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's what I think about with those lines.
Okay, well, let's hear the song. This is Everybody Knows, the Dixie Chicks.
Tell me now if you came sneaking up behind. Would you know me and see behind the smile? I can change like colors on a wall, hoping no one else will find what lies beneath it all. I think I hide it all so well. Stepping out, everyone can see my face, all the things I
That's the Dixie Chicks from their new CD, Taken the Long Way. And my guests are the three members of the Dixie Chicks. Marty and Emily, you started the group before you even met Natalie, and you had a different performers with you when you started. I know you both grew up playing bluegrass and going to bluegrass competitions. I think you both played fiddle when you were girls. You know, when you were young.
Actually, my mom started us on Suzuki violin. It was a rite of passage when you turned 5 in our family. You had to start a Suzuki of one type or another. Our older sister took piano, and Marty and I played violin. And I guess as we got older, our dad was a country music fan, so as we got older, Marty went to fiddle, and I don't think she wanted her little sister playing fiddle. So I went on in search of my own instrument, and the banjo called from across the bluegrass concert hall. And so, yeah, I mean, from a very early age, we were in lessons.
So did you have other friends who liked bluegrass music? Were you?
No.
No.
Absolutely not.
And, you know, we found friends through bluegrass once we kind of got into it. Marty was in a kids band. She started in a kids band called Blue Night Express. It was the youngest, Texas' youngest bluegrass band. And then I joined when I was 12. And
does that make you that kind of freaks? Like, here they are, ladies and gentlemen, the tot bluegrass band, you know, the youngest bluegrass kids.
That was just our own moniker. We didn't know. I don't think anybody knew who we were.
That's what the T-shirt said.
Yeah.
We don't know if that's true.
We were always in competition with the Pee-wee Pickers.
That's right.
What was it like to start off musically in a competitive way, going to competitions? Did that take any of the joy out of the music?
It wasn't really like that. We went to just perform at a lot of the festivals, and there would happen to be a banjo contest or a fiddle contest. And yes, I fought with my parents over whether I wanted to be in the fiddle contest. It was a lot of pressure, but it was more, you know, I really...
So who wanted what?
I didn't want to enter because, yeah, it was nerve-wracking. But my parents, you know, were really smart. They made it a family affair, and we were city girls growing up in Dallas and going to private school where my mother taught. And, yes, you know, no, we weren't getting exposed to anything like that where we were living. And they kind of sought it out and made it something really great the family could do together. We'd go camping and we'd hear other bands. And the more Emily and I were around other musicians that were either our age or older or just, you know, great pickers who kind of took us under their wing. So I think because we were going to see live music our whole lives long, we were constantly getting inspired. And therefore, we kept it up and we kept practicing and wanting to make it a career.
Natalie, your father, Lloyd Maines, is a very well-known, very well-respected pedal steel guitar player and also record producer. And he played with the Dixie Chicks before you did and was co-producing their records before you joined up with them. So before we get to how you... Well, why don't we get to it now? How did you end up joining the Dixie Chicks after your father was already playing with them?
I was in college. Well, I guess I was probably in high school when he played on their records, but I don't know exactly. They have more perspective from what happened on their end, but I was in college and they called to see if I would sing a song that they wrote, and I said yes, and then I quickly got nervous that I wasn't going to like the song, and I'm not one to be able to fake my way through things. So I wound up loving the song. It was You Were Mine, and little did I know it was an audition, which I did not know that. And then Marty called one night and asked if I'd move to Dallas. We had a gig in about 10 days. I had to learn 24 songs, and in 2 days...
Are you kidding?
Moved to Dallas.
Wow.
Lived with headphones on and had a big art pad with just key words that would just jog my memory in case of a forgetful moment. And I loved it. You know, at that stage, I, of course, knew who they were, and they heard me sing from a tape my dad had given them, and he wasn't giving it to them to pitch me to them. my dad's just proud like that, and he gave him my Berklee School of Music audition tape, and that's how they heard about me.
So, Natalie, what was it like for you knowing that your father was already, you know, a member or at least a semi-regular in the band? Was that an inhibiting or a comforting idea? Was it awkward for you to play with him?
No, I love playing with my dad, but I wouldn't even call – he wasn't really even a member of the band.
Just on the record.
The records and then just really a sparse gig here and there. Mm-hmm. No, I would love it. I would be so proud. And I remember when we played with Buck Owens, and that's another strange thing. Even though my dad's a musician, we didn't talk a lot about music. I sort of learned about my dad's musical taste and history from reading interviews he had done or listening to other people ask him questions. But I had learned that that he and his brothers knew every single Buck Owens tune, and that's what he played in clubs. Those were the first songs that he learned, and we played Buck Owens Club, and my dad played with us, and I just remember being really proud that, you know, my dad probably, you know, in his wildest dreams never thought he would be on stage with his daughter and Buck Owens, and you could just see it. And the same thing with James Taylor. My family, that was the one music we could agree on in the car trip on the way to Colorado or whatever our summer vacation was. And when I got to play with James Taylor and my dad, it was surreal. It was unbelievable. And my dad is not a crier. He's a very man's man. And his eyes were watering.
My guests are the Dixie Chicks. Their new CD is called Taking the Long Way. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the Dixie Chicks, lead singer Natalie Maines, banjo player Emily Robison, and fiddler Marty McGuire. Their new CD is called Taking the Long Way. Marty and Emily, you're sisters, and the song So Hard is about how you've both had infertility treatments, and you both have twins now. So do you attribute the twinness to the infertility treatments?
We knew that there was a chance. I think in my case, there's a 30% chance I would have twins. And Emily and I tried for many years to get pregnant, and that was what we ended up having to do. And it was an emotional process, and it's something that we do talk about because it's strange. I mean, among our friends and family, it seems about 50-50, people having to find some alternative help way to help them conceive. And I think growing up, you just think it's a given.
So what's it like now when you're on the road and there's seven children between the three of you? Do they all travel with you? Do you have a daycare center?
They do all travel with us, but we haven't been on the road with them yet.
And during the hiatus when you weren't recording, did you all see each other a lot? Do you live near each other?
It's funny. Natalie's forced to spend a lot of time with me.
Yeah, it's painful.
Because I married her sister's husband's brother. So we met at Natalie's sister Kim's wedding and quickly fell in love. And now...
Who, me and you?
Yeah. And, you know, now we share a lot of the same family, and we get together at Christmas and different holidays. And, I mean, we're all friends anyway. And, of course, Emily's my sister, so we're always going to each other's kids' birthdays when we can. And, yeah, I'd say our lives are pretty intertwined.
Just one more thing before we end. You're about to begin a tour in the summer. When you go on tour, are you going to talk about the war? Are you going to talk about the president? Are you going to make sure to address it? Are you going to make jokes about it? Are you going to kind of act like nothing ever happened? Like, how are you going to deal with this on stage?
Well, I mean, we had a tour after this. Our tour was sold out before the comment was made. So it is a part of who we are as a band now, whether we asked for it or wanted it or like it. And it's fine. It's a role that we take on. We're never ones to ignore something. But there's no plan, and I don't say the same thing every night. And usually what I do is joke and stay lighthearted. But, you know, who knows? You know, most people in the crowd at our shows agree with us, so it's sort of preaching to the choir, you know. It's more just a it's just fun, and there's no political agenda.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you
very much.
The Dixie Chicks' new CD is called Taking the Long Way. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
We were young and so inspired. We were the only ones who thought we'd change the world.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And from BMW, where the halls are filled with independent thinkers because the company is independent too. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the real dirt on Farmer John. We talk with John Peterson, the subject of a new documentary about his farm. It tells a larger story about farming. Peterson grew up on a family farm. For a while, he turned part of it into an artist's commune. Debt forced him to sell much of the land. Now he has a successful organic farm. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.